Seeing as it looks like we're at a pretty much full house, so I may as well get started. So hopefully you're in the right session. This is Web 2.0.3, and it's called Chasing the Evolving Web. My name is Aaron Powell. I'm a senior developer and technical web specialist with Redify. I'm also a Microsoft Internet Explorer development MVP. So ultimately, we're here to talk about HTML5. But a bit more than that, we're here to talk about the parts that make up HTML5 in total. So parts like CSS3, multi-device support, offline caching, media, multimedia support, and things like that. So why is this talk called Chasing the Evolving Web? Well, in recent years, we've seen a massive shift in the way web browsers have been treated. For a long time, web browsers were something that kind of just evolved slow and steady. But in recent years, we've seen it really change pace. Earlier this year, we saw IE9 released. And then right on the back of that, we had IE10 Platform Preview 1 released. We've also had Platform Preview 2 released since then. And Microsoft is targeting around an 8 to 12 week release cycle with the platform previews. Firefox is doing a similar thing. They've got about a 14 week release cycle. When I first gave this talk back in May, the version of Firefox that was available at the time was version 4. As you might be aware, version 6 came out last week, or the week before, can't remember rightly. So there's actually been two releases of Firefox since I first gave this talk not that many months ago. And Mozilla themselves are targeting around about a 14-week release cycle. We probably also know the Chrome release cycle story. Chrome no longer calls itself by a version number. They just release a ridiculous number of versions. I think version 14 is the current stable if you're actually interested in reading the version numbers. But they're targeting around a 12-week release cycle. And again, we're seeing just browsers coming out faster and faster than we'd seen before, or at least for quite a number of years. It harks back to the days of the first browser wars. So it's browser war v2. So we want to talk about the things that are happening. Because these browsers are moving so fast, that we're getting a lot of different things happening, and it's making it a lot harder to develop on the web platform. So throughout the course of this talk, I'm going to be looking at some various tools and libraries that can help you be proactive web developers and be able to produce good web applications for the current browser market. So the first thing that I want to look at is a tool called HTML5 Boilerplate. You might be familiar with this. If you're not, HTML5 Boilerplate it's not really a flashy tool. It doesn't do anything exciting, but it does something that a really good tool should do, and it doesn't get in your way, and it does something that you don't like doing. So I'm just going to jump over to WebMatrix and show you what HTML5 Boilerplate looks like. As I said, HTML5 Boilerplate is nothing exciting at all. What we've got here is what you can download from the website. I'll put the links up at the end of the slide deck so you can grab them yourselves. But this is what you get. Nothing exciting. It's a folder structure, really. And also what comes with it is a bunch of default files. Comes with things such as a CSS normalization file. So this is something that we've used for quite a number of years. You might also be familiar with it as a browser reset or a CSS reset file. But this is slightly different an approach. Rather than turning all elements back to a zero setting, so removing all padding, removing all font styling, removing all margins, removing all borders, removing everything from all elements, it removes only the things that you don't really need on particular elements. There's no point in changing the emphasis element, so the EM, back to a non-italic font, because ultimately that's the point of emphasis, is to italicize. And you're probably going to do that anyway. So this file will do those kind of things for you and just gets it out of the way so you don't have to worry about doing it yourself. But on top of that, it will also do things such as set up default places, if I just scroll down a bit, default places for, say, your media queries. So if you're doing a web application and you're targeting multi-device support, you want to be able to, say, use media queries. You might have seen the CSS3 talk yesterday that was talking about media queries, so I won't go into too great a depth, but essentially a media query allows you to, say, apply this block of styles to a particular screen resolution. In this case, we've got one for 480 pixels, one for 768 pixels as a width. You can do a whole bunch of other things. You've probably seen media queries for a number of years in the form of print style sheets. That's also something that we get out of the box with HTML5 Boilerplate. It's a basic print style sheet. The version that I've got here is the commented version. You can also download an uncommented version from the the HTML5 boilerplate website, so you don't have to have all this guff within your files anyway. But here we've got a basic print style sheet as well. So it's those things that you'll probably do if you're doing a web application, but you don't want to have to do them every time because it's just not fun. I develop because I want to develop things that are fun. I don't want to have to do the same things over and over again, and this gets that out of the way. It does some other things with HTML5 boilerplate. So it brings in a bunch of default libraries, such as jQuery, Modernizer, which I'll talk about in a bit later. Gives you some points of things that you'll commonly forget. So I commonly forget to put in 404 pages. It would be the number of times that I've had a site and it's 404'd and I'm like, oh, that's right. I've just got this white screen with an ASP.NET server error because there's no URL to go to. It also has a default index page. And again, this is doing things that you just get bored doing as a web developer. Writing out a doc type every single time. Putting in if conditionals for the different versions of IE so we can put a different CSS class on the HTML and be able to target the different versions of IE specifically using the IE conditional statements. It's got the UA compatibility header put in there. And what this does is, for IE, it will tell it to use a particular version of IE regardless of what version of IE you've got installed. Obviously, if you've got IE6 installed, it won't run as IE9. But if you've got IE9 installed and you specify that you want to run it as IE7, you're crazy, but you can do it. The best idea is to run as IE Edge, and this does it for you. It's something that you don't have to remember to do yourself. It does other things, so it just puts in a skeleton HTML for your actual page layout using some HTML5 tags, your headers and your footers, things like that. So these are all things that you're going to be doing in a web app, but if you can get something that will do them for you up front and you not have to worry about them, you just download this tool and then start doing the actual exciting and important parts of your application, it's going to save you time. Another thing that I always forget is Google Analytics code. All you've got to do in here is change the actual code. You don't have to grab out the whole HTML. So if you're doing lots of web applications, you might actually know what numbers you're going to be generating for your next Google Analytics tracking code. So it puts all that kind of stuff in there for you. So as I said, HTML5 boilerplate isn't an exciting project. It just does something really well, and it does it really simply, and it gets out of your way. So just as a quick recap, it's a great way when you're starting a new project or you're starting new pages or something like that. And it includes a bunch of things that you're going to want out of the box, up front. So a CSS normalizer, includes a version of jQuery for you, some Google Analytics, things like that. So the next thing I want to talk about is HTML5, CSS3, and JavaScript version 5. So ECMAScript 5, which we're seeing coming into more modern browsers. So as I said, we're seeing browsers evolve at a much faster rate than we'd seen in the past. So we're getting release cycles of less than 15 days, generally speaking, for a new version of a browser. But each time we get a new version, it's adding some features. We're getting slightly closer to being a full HTML5, CSS3, and JavaScript 5 clients. But we've still got old browsers. We know that IE6 has a market share. It's dwindling, thankfully, but there is still a market share for IE6. IE7 and 8, they also have market shares. Firefox 3.6 has a market share as well, and still quite a big market share because the release process around the newer versions of Firefox has changed since then. So people that are not as proactive as updating might still be staying on an older version of Firefox. So we need to make sure that as we're developing applications, we're going to be able to give a good experience to these people that are still on older browsers that haven't taken the initiative to upgrade their machines. So how do we do this? Traditionally, we use the concept of user agent sniffing. This is actually a really bad idea. User agent sniffing is a very problematic thing on the web because user agents can be faked. We're asking the browser, who are you? And I could go up to any person in here and say, who are you? And if I don't look at their name tag, obviously, they can tell me that their name is John, and it's not their name. Browsers can do exactly the same thing. All modern browsers have extensions that allow you to switch the user agent. So just because the browser is telling you that it's IE7 doesn't mean that it's actually IE7. It also has another problem. We're locking ourselves into the browsers that we know about. So if I write an application today and I use user agent sniffing, I know the most modern browsers available today in common population are IE9, Firefox 6, and Chrome Infinity. I don't know, 14, or I'm pretty sure is the latest stable. But if I try and use the user agent sniff those in 20 weeks' time, it's probably going to be a new Firefox. It's probably going to be a new Chrome. There's probably going to be five new Chromes. And in 6 months' time, there might be the new version of IE. But I don't know about those because I only knew about IE9, Firefox 6, and Chrome 14. So that's a bit of a problem. There was a great example happened a couple of years ago when the browser started getting towards the elusive version 10. I think Opera was the first one to hit that. And a whole bunch of user agent sniffing tools fell apart because they were using regexes that didn't realize that we were going to hit two digits in our user agent at some point. Whoops. So if user agent sniffing is bad, it's something we've relied on for a number of years, what is our alternative? The alternative is the idea of feature detection. And this is something that we're seeing a lot more happen on the web. So the idea of feature detection is, rather than asking the browser who you are, you ask the browser what it can do. So we use various techniques and say, can you do this? And the browser, it's a whole lot harder for the browser to lie about that than it is to lie about what version it actually is. So I'm just going to do a quick demo of how we can use feature detection. So I'm just going to load up Visual Studio here and go to Project. So let's say I want to do an application and I want to have HTML5 video. If someone comes to my site on IE8, they're not going to be able to use HTML5 video. So I want to be able to make sure that if I'm putting in a video tag, it's going to be something that they can use. So I'm going to start with just a jQuery onReady function and type out document.createElement. Document.createElement. Video. So what I'm going to tell is I want the browser to create a video element using the DOM API. So what this is going to do, it's giving me an object here that I could do something like this. If video dot can play type. So the can play type is a method that is available on the video object if you have a browser that supports HTML5 video. This you then pass in a type of the video that you want to play. It will then say yes or no. It says slightly more information than that. And we can then display an MPEG or the various different video formats that are supported on the web. So if I know that... So what I'm doing here is I'm using the double not operation in JavaScript, which kind of forces... If you've done a lot of JavaScript development, you'll know that the concept of false in JavaScript is a little weird. If you want to know more about that, come see me afterwards. This is not a in-depth JavaScript talk. But what I'm doing here is I'm forcing this to be a Boolean value. So I will always get back a true or false and a proper true or false from JavaScript. So if I know that my browser doesn't support HTML5 video, what can I do? I can do something like a fallback to Silverlight. So if I can't serve you out a HTML5 video, I want to serve you out a Silverlight video player instead. So rather than watching me type this all out, I'll just... That's how fast I can code. So what I'm doing here is, if the browser doesn't support HTML5 video, I'm going to load up a Silverlight video player. And I give it the video I want to play instead of our HTML5 video. And hopefully everything's good, assuming they've got Silverlight installed. It's a whole another problem. If they don't have Silverlight installed, you can check for Silverlight. If they don't have that installed, you could fall back to another technology or just provide them with an information message saying, sorry, you can't actually view the video on our site. Go get a new browser. So that's an example of feature detection for a part of HTML5 that is in the DOM. But what if we wanted to use, say, a new browser API? Say we wanted to use the geolocation API that is part of HTML5. So I'm just going to use another bit of magic code. So how many people have played around with the geolocation API or are aware of the geolocation API in new browsers? Cool. So for those of you that aren't aware, you might have actually come across it without realizing it if you've been on your Windows Phone 7 or your iDevice and you've gone to a website and it's propped up a notification saying this site would like to use your current location. That's part of HTML5's geolocation. And what it does is it allows the browser to query whereabouts you actually are. And it's quite sophisticated the way it does it. And it's also kind of scary that from my web browser, it can tell me that I'm standing in this building in the Gold Coast. But if we wanted to use this on our site, how would we detect that? So we can check if the navigator has the geolocation object, which is where this new API is. And then after that, we can check to make sure that it has the getCurrentPosition method. So this is the method that we call to do something with geolocation. So the next little code bit that I've got down the bottom is where we invoke the getCurrentPosition function, and then we can do something like draw your current location on the map with the results that we get back. So the advantage of this is that we could, say, still draw the map, and the user can have a text box where they type in their current location or a location that they want. Or we can ask the browser, and provided that they say yes, the browser can tell you where I am, we can automatically position them on our map. And this can be really useful for, say, a store locator, in an application that you could be working on. So that's feature detection. So just as a quick recap, don't use user agent sniffing. User agents can be faked. The IE9 DevTools is actually a great example of this. I had a problem at work a couple of weeks ago where one of my colleagues was looking at a page that I'd worked on and was like, your page is just doesn't work. It keeps throwing JavaScript errors at me. I'm like, works on my machine. Means it's good, right? Shipped to production. It works. And we had a look, and he was running IE9. I was running IE9. We were running the same build versions, but he was getting this JavaScript error, and I wasn't. Couldn't work out until we loaded up the DevTools and realized that he'd actually changed his version of IE9. He'd used the switching in IE9. Not sure if you've seen this. So in IE9, we've got two options here we can change. We can change the browser mode, swap it back to all the way back up to IE7. We can also change the document mode. And this will affect our user agent. And he'd actually changed one of these because he was giving a demo on the way the browsers, older browsers worked. But it was a very hard thing to detect because we were both using IE9, but the IE9 that he was using was lying about who it actually was. So that's why you shouldn't use user agent sniffing. Instead, you should be using feature detection, and you should be asking the browser what it can do rather than who it is. But what if we want to do some complex feature detection? Say we wanted to do something like detecting the font face option. Wanted to detect canvas. Wanted to detect canvas text. Wanted to detect something that is impossible to read. If we wanted to detect HTML5 video, audio, and a myriad of other different things that are part of CSS3 and HTML5. Yeah, that's how many different things that we could be detecting. So there's a lot of different things, and I don't want to have to write this code every time. I want someone else to write this code for me, because some of these things can be really difficult to detect. Hands up who reckons they know how you would detect border shadow. I don't. Well, I know what you would do to detect border shadow, but I don't really want to have to write that. So how do we detect this? Well, we could use a lot of complex JavaScript that we write ourselves and we've got to maintain, and then the new browser comes along and we've got to make sure that we're detecting against that. Or we can use another tool called Modernizer. So this is a tool written by a couple of very smart web guys, and it is basically used for the sole purpose of doing feature detection. So I want to demonstrate two tools here. I want to demonstrate Modernizer, and I want to just demonstrate another tool called YepNopeJS. So YepNopeJS is a library that is useful for doing loading of JavaScript, so JavaScript and CSS files, so asynchronous loading. So I'm just going to jump back to Visual Studio. We'll have a look at how we can use this. Sure, we can save that file. So I'll just start off with a quick demonstration of Nope.js. And it's easier if it's in a script tag. JavaScript works a whole lot better when it's in script tags. So here is an example of how we could use Nope.js to just load in a piece of JavaScript, a JavaScript file. Here I want to load in jQuery from the Microsoft CDN. Because I'm a good developer, I want to use the CDN so I don't have to A, manage the files myself, and B, get the advantage of caching that we can get from a CDN. But I got this problem. I like to work on the train on the way home. I'm that into my job that I just love working on the train on the way home. So I don't have an internet connection. I live in Sydney, and the even 3G connection on the trains is, that's lucky. So the CDN is not going to work, and I don't want my application to crash. Or in production, I don't want if the ASP.NET CDN ever fell over, heaven forbid the actual Microsoft CDN went down, I don't want my application to completely fall over. So what can I do instead? So I will just add another bit of code. So Nope allows us to fires a callback function when it has finished loading in the scripts or the CSS that you've specified. So what I'm doing here is, in the complete function, I'm checking to see if window.jQuery, so if jQuery did successfully load in, that's cool, do whatever you want. Otherwise, I want to then load in my local version of jQuery. So when I'm disconnected from the web, I can still work. If the CDN is down for some reason, my site's still going to work. So this starts getting really powerful because I can then have multiple nested conditionals. If various things happen, I can still continue to load in my files. So another thing that you can do with Nope is provide prefixes, and it will load files in conditionally based on a prefix. So I've got a CSS style sheet that I want to include when I'm working in IE6 and 7. I can put it in the top, and I can put in my own IE conditionals, as we saw in the HTML5 boilerplate, the IE conditionals. Or I can use Nope.js to do that. And I just prefix it with this IE6 bang, IE7 bang, and then the file that I want to include. And it will do the logic under the as part of its loader to work out whether I'm in an IE6 or an IE7 browser, and then it will load in that file correctly. So what about Modernizer? I said that Modernizer is a great feature detection tool, so let's have a look at it. Of course, I set that snippet to be JavaScript instead of HTML. There's a little problem there. So Modernizer, as I said, is a tool that got released by a couple of really smart web guys. And what I'm going to be running here is the development version of Modernizer. This includes all those things that we saw on the previous slide that I had to click through, like 30 different feature detections. So it includes all of those. But chances are you're not going to need most of them on your site. So they offer, on their website, ability to do custom builds of Modernizer that includes only the feature detection tests that you require. So in my script tag here, I want to do a Modernizer test. And here's how I can test for text shadow. Don't have to worry about what it's actually doing under the hood. I don't have to do a query against CSS to see if the text shadow property actually got set appropriately. Instead, Modernizer does that for me, and I just call modernizer.textshadow. And you'll see here we're actually using Nope as well. So Nope, another one that we didn't use up earlier, was this test property. So I pass in something saying that I want to do a test. I want to test this, and it's going to return me a Boolean value. So true if the browser supports text shadow, false if it doesn't. And here, Nope, doesn't support text shadow. So I'm going to start loading in a couple of polyfills. So a polyfill is a replacement for a missing feature in a browser. So in this case, I'm using a jQuery plugin that is going to simulate text shadow. I'm going to load in some other things, such as a CSS file, and then lastly, something to actually kick that off. So that's how we can use Modernizer to load in some of that. But what if I've got multiple tests? I mean, it's very unlikely that I'm only going to need to test one feature of HTML5 or CSS3 on my site. So I can pass in an array of array of tests here. So here's another one that I'm testing. I'm testing for modernizer input types. I'm checking to see if the date input type is supported in my current browser. The only browser that actually supports the date input type properly at the moment is Opera. Chrome says it supports it, and you can put in an input type date, but it renders a number field. And I'm pretty sure the other browsers just don't do it at all. So instead of using the built-in browser features, I'm then going to fall back to the jQuery date picker from the jQuery UI toolkit. So again, here we're using the browser. It's asking the browser, does it support this? If it doesn't, cool. We'll do it our own way. One other really nifty thing about Modernizer is it allows you to write your own tests. So here I want to see if my browser supports the marquee tag. The marquee tag is the future of the web. So I just wanted to use this as an illustration of the extensibility capabilities of Modernizer. So what I'm doing here is I'm using modernizer.addTest, giving the test a name, and then providing some logic for the test. So if anyone's interested, this is how you check to see if the marquee tag is available in your browser. You want to be able to fall back to a jQuery plugin for that. And then we could use it, pass it into JS and do a conditional on that, exactly the same as we're doing with text shadow, the date input field, etc. So I'll just jump back. Whoop. So these are all the kinds of things that Modernizer can detect. One really cool one is media queries. So Modernizer can actually detect whether your browser supports media queries. So if not, you can use another way to provide a CSS for your appropriate resolution. So just as a quick recap, YepNope.js is a really good asynchronous script loader and CSS loader. It's also got the really good advantage of being able to have conditional logic in there. Something I didn't show was that you can also provide in a yep. So where I had test, nope, I can provide a yep. So if it does have that feature, I can do something specific. So in the scenario two demos back where we were testing to see if we had geolocation support, I could pass in the operations that I wanted to do there as a yep scenario. And Modernizer is a fantastic feature detection library. Again, the links to these will be up at the end of the slides. But Modernizer is being really actively developed. A couple other things that I didn't show you about Modernizer is that it includes the fix for IE less than 9 to have HTML5 tags actually render as HTML tags. It includes a workaround to make that happen. So if you do put a video tag in there, it's not going to show up as just plain text, or it's not going to fall apart. You can still style them and all those kind of things. It's a nice little workaround in IE to do that. And it does that for you. It also does some fixes around handling print style sheets and things like that. And it's a great way to be proactive and make sure that you're supporting older browsers as well as the current generation of browsers on your site. So the next thing I want to talk about is simplifying common tasks in your application. When we're working with, say, Ajax, how do we do something like caching? Should we be doing caching? How do we do a good RESTful interface to $.ajax if we're working with jQuery or if we're using some other Ajax library? Can we make that look more RESTful? How do we deal with something like testing? How can we make sure that we can provide a good test scenario around that client code? What about browser storage? So in everything from IE8 upwards, we've got this idea of local and session storage, and this allows us to put some information into the browser that will be persisted. So local storage will be persisted across browser restarts. Session storage is only there until the browser browser closes. And what if we wanted to say build some complex value and put it into a cookie? How can we do something like that? Or the idea of communicating across JavaScript components, or PubSub is another name for the pattern that we're about to look at. So I want to talk about another JavaScript library. This one is called AmplifyJS, and it's a really good tool for dealing with those three scenarios that I was just talking about. Okay, so let's start with an example of PubSub. So just going to spin this up in the browser, and this is why you should have 404 pages. So I've got an e-com site here, and I want to happen every time someone clicks on the add cart button, I want to do something. I might want to show an increment to the cart that's visible on the page. Currently don't have a cart, so I don't want my browser to crash. So I'm working on this part of the page, I'm working on displaying this section, listing out all my products, and another developer in my team is working on the actual shopping cart display functionality. So I'm working on this, and I want to make sure that when I click this button, my browser doesn't crash, because I'm being very proactive, I'm writing unit tests and all those awesome things that we do a lot in JavaScript. That's not the reaction I was hoping for. So how can I still wire up this button to do something if there is no one there to do anything with it? If a tree falls in a forest, okay, that's too zen. So I'm going to start with a script tag. You might notice that I'm not putting a type in my script tag. It's because in HTML5, you don't have to specify the type. You don't really have to specify it in HTML4 either. The browsers will, if you don't specify a type, just assume that it's going to be JavaScript. So you can save yourself like 20 characters. It's a lot of typing. Oops, wrong demo. Okay, so what I'm doing is whenever there is a button on this page, so I'm just going to find all the buttons on here, I want the click event to fire an event saying add to cart. So this is similar to .NET eventing if you're doing backend logic. So I'm just saying that this has happened. If someone listens to it, that's cool. They can do something with it. So it's a bit more disconnected than standard eventing. So we'll just save that. We'll go back to our browser, reload. And we're not getting any errors. Because I'm clicking on the button. It is actually doing something. I promise it's actually doing something. So we've got to the point of integration. I've finished my part. I just need to drop in the shopping cart. So let's do that now. So I'm just dropping in a partial in my MVC that's going to display a shopping cart. Now if I jump over to here, reload the browser. So there we go. We've got our shopping cart displayed. But when I click on this add to cart button, it's not doing anything. It's not incrementing the number of items in my shopping cart. So for this, we'll also add, whoa, what happened there? Let's close that file. And come back. There we go. So I want to use this. So now I'm going to subscribe to the event. So if I jump back to our other file, you'll see that here I'm using amplify.publish and giving it a name add to cart. So in another JavaScript file, I'm subscribing to something called add to cart, and then I'm passing in a callback function of what I want to do. In this case, I'm doing something very simple. I'm just going to increment the number in the cart. It's not really going to persist anywhere, so you're not really buying anything on my awesome little store. But if we reload our browser, and something fails. Yeah. Control F5. Come on. Demos are so much cooler when they work. There was no buttons when I added that. At least I hope it is. That problem. There we go. Yay! If that is the worst the demo gods have for me today, I'm going to be so excited. So now you see that every time I'm clicking this add cart, it's incrementing this component on the right-hand side. These components don't know about each other. One just knows that someone might say add to cart. The other one just knows that just says that someone has added to cart. Even from my JavaScript console down here, I could do amplify.publish add to cart. And it will keep incrementing the list up the side. So these two components don't know about each other. And this is a concept that we've probably been very familiar with developing in .NET of eventing. And this is just a really good way that you can do it in JavaScript. What if we wanted to do something a little bit more fancy than this kind of listener? I could instead do an AJAX response. And this is a nice segue to talking about the request API with Amplify. So here I'm defining a request called update cart that Amplify is then going to handle itself. So I'll jump over to my next little demo about how we can simplify and make a little bit more of a RESTful interface to doing JavaScript development. AJAX development. If you want to be really, really awesome and quick, there is going to be a live tweet stream on stage. Go! Yep. Just had to see if anyone is... We'll find out if anyone is wanting their 15 seconds of fame. So here I'm going to use Amplify and define a new request type. So here I use request.define. I give it a name. It's called Search Twitter. I didn't actually tell you what I'm actually going to be searching for on Twitter, so it's going to be fun. So then we're saying that this is going to be an AJAX request, and I'll get to why that's important in a moment. And then we're defining what this request looks like. So I'm going to have a URL that I'll hit. I'm going to have a data type of JSONP. It's going to have some caching to it. So this is built into to Amplify. It's going to deal with caching on our behalf. So we don't have to, if this URL gets called multiple times, it's going to just use a cached response until the duration expires. So how do we use this? So what we do is we use amplify.request, and then we give it the name of the request that we defined earlier. So normally I wouldn't do these in the same files. This is demo code. Demo code is not production code. Normally I would define a bunch of requests in my files, in one file up front, and then in the places that I require a usage of those requests, I would have the second code snippet that I've just put in. Because all I'm doing here is I'm saying that I want to use the request name search Twitter. I want to pass some data to it. In this case, I'm going to pass a query of AU TechEd. And then I pass in a callback function. So if you've done work with jQuery, AJAX, or any other AJAX library, you will be familiar with this kind of a concept. But instead of giving it a URL, we give it a name for something that we want to do. So then in my callback function here, I am doing jQuery templating. So if we spin this back up in our browser and ignore that error. Oops. Put this back up. So home. Yay! Thank you for whoever tweeted that. So what we've got here is we've just used this idea of a request response API. So I've just defined something up front that matches our request, and then we've used it later on in our code. So I said that I've passed in AJAX as the type of the request, and whether or not that's kind of an important thing to be passing in. So Something that you can do with Amplify is define your own request type. So say you're working with OData. You can define a request type of OData here, and then in the arguments that you pass in the third parameter, you can specify how it deals with OData and how that response is going to come back. And then in your consumer of it, in your amplify.request, and you just pass in the key of the request that you want, there's nothing specific here that says it's going to be coming from OData, or it's going to be coming from Ajax, or it could even be coming from just a local in-memory JavaScript object. It doesn't matter. It just says that I'm requesting something by this key, here's some data for it, and here's what I want to do when you give me back a response. So this is really advantageous for doing that kind of development. It's also really advantageous if you want to do testing of your Ajax. So if you've ever tried to do JavaScript testing, you'll know that it's not easy. If you've ever tried to do JavaScript testing with Ajax calls, you'll know that it's really not easy. So we could define a request type of testing and then put in some mock response there that we then include that file in our test library and don't include our initial definition file. But the rest of our code just assumes that it works because it doesn't know that your data source is now a test library. The last thing I just wanted to have a quick look at is the storage API with Amplify.js. So with this, Amplify has Amplify.store, and what we're doing here is we give it a key and we can give it some data. So if you've ever worked with local storage or session storage, you'll know that they can only store string values. But it's very rare that you're just using a string value in JavaScript. You probably have a complex object, such as this first example here. And the Amplify API is going to deal with that itself. It's going to serialize it down to JSON string, push it into the store, and then you can get it back as your complex object. So I'll just spin this example up in the browser. Store. And it doesn't do anything interesting there. What is interesting is, if I can remember where it is in here, I did not just do this. So what I wanted to show you down here, just zoom in a bit. You'll see that here is a view of local storage in the browser. I know it's somewhere in the IE DevTools, but I can't remember off the top of my head, so I know where it is here. It's a whole bunch quicker than me fumbling on stage for a good 5 minutes. So Amplify is storing the values that we've passed in. I've passed in something with store example 1, store example 2. Here it's a complex object. You'll see that it's serialized it down. You can also set expiries on your values. So if you're storing something in local storage, and so you want to persist something across browser restarts, but you only want to persist it for, say, 24 hours. And if the person comes back to your site, doesn't come back to your site in 24 hours, you want that data to be destroyed. Some good examples of why you would use something like this is, say, an offline reader. You want to make an application that... Like Google Reader or some kind of a reader for your for an RSS, you can store the information into local storage. Just be aware that there is limitations on the amount that you can put in that. But this does work in everything from IE8 upwards. And you'll see that we haven't really done anything in here to specify that I wanted to store it in local store versus session storage. Amplify, I can specify that. I can also specify if I want to persist it back to a cookie. So I can tie this in with Modernizer. Check with Modernizer if it supports local storage. If it doesn't support local storage, okay, cool. I'm going to fall back to using a cookie. And this is how some of these libraries can come back to come together. So that's Amplify in a bit of a nutshell. So Amplify is really useful for communicating between disconnected JavaScript components, pub-sub, or it's similar to an observable pattern as well. So if we just want to play buzzword bingo, pub-sub, observable pattern, Ajax, HTML5, CSS3, bingo. No. Yes. This is not a cloud session. No. You know, you're not allowed to mention that here. So some other things that were useful for Amplify is the request response API, that we define a generic handler for some data coming back, a generic handler for our response, and then we can define how that response is handled, be it through an AJAX call, through our own custom ways such as OData, local objects for testing, etc. What if we wanted to do an application that's a bit more complex and we wanted to have a really rich UI? We're used to, from, say, client app development, and obviously we're seeing a lot of web apps evolving to work in browser, desktop apps to be kind of browser-focused as well. How do we give that kind of a rich experience? When I'm interacting with the page, how do I ensure that I make a change in one place and it does update in all the other places? I change my name and it updates my username at the top of the page, etc. Well, in this one, I want to talk about Knockout.js. So hands up who's used Knockout.js. Hands up who came to the talk yesterday where I talked about Knockout.js for about 2 minutes and then said, come here because it's going to be a whole lot more interesting. Hopefully, it's going to be a lot more interesting. So for anyone that's not familiar with Knockout.js, it's essentially the MVVM pattern implemented in JavaScript with a binding syntax that you'll be familiar with if you've come from a Silverlight or WPF background. I'll bring up my code examples now, and I'll talk through a bit more of what we're doing here. So I've got my copy of Knockout. It's actually maintained by a guy from Microsoft UK, if I recall correctly. It's definitely making big inroads in the Microsoft community at the moment because of its similarities with WPF. So I want to build a really exciting to-do application because it's not Twitter, and the other demo that you have to do is a to-do application. So I'm going to do something simple like display a list. Oops. Display a list of options in my UI. Go, and of course it's done that. Home, Knockout. So that's very exciting. I have an empty list box. I want to obviously populate this with some data that I've got, but I don't want to have to write up all this wiring code. I'm going to have a collection of to-do items. Then how do I display that in the to-do list? Well, I can write a whole bunch of binding code. I can iterate through the list. I can build the select items myself and then push them into the select list in the UI, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm going to start with our trusty script tag. So I'm going to create a view model here. So you'll see that I've got a view model, and it's going to have two properties on it. One is called all items, which is all the items that are available within my to-do list. And the next is the selected items. So I'm only going to have one here, but just as an example, I'm saying that I could have multiple selected by default within my select list down below. So if we have a bit more of a look at the HTML that I've put out here, see that I've got this data-bind syntax. So we're using the data attributes that are part of HTML5, and data attribute allows you to put any arbitrary attribute onto a HTML object as long as you prefix it with data-star, and then it's got an inbuilt API in the browser that makes it easier to interact with. This works fine in all browsers as well, data-bind. It's just that the newer browsers have a better API for dealing with that. Firefox 6 only just implemented it. It's been in Chrome for a while, and it's in IE9. If I recall correctly. So what I'm doing here is specifying that I want the options of my select list to be all items, and then I want selected options, so this is something specific to Knockout.js, so selected options will be from this property here called selected items. So back up in our view model, so MVVM is model view view model. It's a pattern for Silverlight developers. I'm not really sure of the origins of MVVM or anything like that, but it's a really useful pattern, particularly within a web context like this as well. So what we've got is our view model, which represents the data that we want to display. So here I've got, as I said, I've got the all items property, and I'm creating a new knockout.observable. So this is something that knockout provides, so ko.observable array. So I'm creating an observable array that means that knockout can know when changes happen here. And I'm passing in an array of things that I want to display. And then for selected items, again, I'm using an observable array. I could just use the standard knockout observable if I only wanted to have one selected item. But as I said, I wanted this demo, I could have multiple selected items if so desired. So we'll just reload this back in the browser. And I heard something ding.
No, that was me.
Ah. Well, and here I was thinking I'd broken something. Ah. So one other thing that you've got to do, I've defined my view model. I've now got to tell Knockout to use that view model. So it's similar if you're working with Silverlight or WPF, you provide a data context to your UI. We do a similar thing here. So I've got an apply bindings method, and I say new to-do model. So this will apply the bindings of, so it'll create a new instance of to-do model, and then it will apply that to this page. There's a second argument I can pass in here that specifies the starting DOM element. So if you've got a very large DOM or a very complex DOM, you probably want to do that. Otherwise, Knockout will actually parse your whole DOM tree, and that can become very slow. So it can be problematic. So say you're building, like if you're building user controls in a Silverlight application, you would have a data context for a particular user control. You can do the similar thing here by specifying the DOM object to start with. I'm just going to, for brevity, use the whole page. So we go. It's now taking that view model, and it's displayed in the select list. I've obviously done something wrong, because write talk didn't get selected. Pardon? Quite probably. And I have turned override on. Awesome. Another demo gods. Anyway, so you'll see that it's now bound this and displayed this select list. It's selected the correct item, and I haven't written any JavaScript code, really. I've just got a view model. And I could be getting this view model back from the server and then turning it into a knockout model, something like that. But it's, what, 4 lines of JavaScript and 1 line of HTML. So let's say we want to do something a bit more advanced and make it so we can remove and sort items within our select list. There we go. So now we've got a remove and a sort button that's displayed there. And I want to tie them up so that they'll have operations on our view model. So they'll have callbacks that we can invoke. So in our data bind, I can specify a click. So when this is clicked, I want it to do something. In this case, I want it to do remove selected. It'll be a method that I'll be adding to my view model. And I want it to be enabled, provided that there is at least one item selected. So let's just update our view model. So now we have a selected items. We go. We've got one selected in our UI, which means that the remove button should be clickable. If I click that, I don't have anything selected. It's automatically disabled that button for me. Alternatively, I can click our sort, and because it was already alphabetized, now it's not alphabetized. If I click sort, it's going to sort them in an alphabetical order. And again, we've not really written any JavaScript. We've added some a bit of logic here to do our ordering. I've got some other things here, so I'm specifying that this will be enabled, provided that there is at least one item to sort. There's no point sorting in a single length array. But all of this looks very similar to what we've been doing with Silverlight and WPF for quite a while now. So now we'll finish off our to-do list by making it so we can add items. So now I'm just adding a form to the top of my to-do list that is going to have a text box in it It's going to have a button, and it's going to have a submit handle, obviously, because I'm actually submitting some data here. So now I will just also update my view model, because I've added some functionality to my application. I need my view model to be able to understand that. So now I've added a method for adding a new item. First off, we've got item to add down here, and that is going to be bound a little bit lower down to our text box. So the value will be bound to item to add. And one of the really cool things about Knockout.js is, we reload this in the browser, it automatically wires up that value that was in that text box is automatically connected back to my view model, as you would expect if you're coming from a stateful application background. JavaScript is obviously not a stateful application, and the web is just not a stateful place. So to have that power of when I type in that text box, it's automatically back in our JavaScript view model, it's really good, and it makes it really easy to do these rich applications that I keep talking about. So you see other things, like this button is not enabled at the moment because I don't have any values in here. But now it becomes available as soon as I start typing into it. When I click the items here, it's immediately appearing in my select list. And again, I'm running very minimal amounts of JavaScript code. I'm running some things to, say, deal with the fact that I want the button enabled while there is a value there. And up here in our view model, I'm not doing anything really more complex than making sure that there was, provided there was an item to add, and that the item to add doesn't already exist in the to-do list, I want to add that item and then ultimately clear off the text box. And this is then all getting immediately updated within our UI. I'm not having to do any of that kind of wire-up code of take the value from here, create a new select list item, and then put it into the select list. It happens behind the scenes for me.
What happens in
IE7? This, I believe, is supported from IE6 Plus. I don't have IE7 installed, so I can't demo that for you, but I'm pretty sure that it does support everything from IE7 up.
Switch the browser back to
that. Yeah, it's definitely a little bit... it's not a true simulation of IE7, but yes, we can. There we go. As you'll see, our site is looking a whole lot more awesome with bigger buttons thanks to IE7. There we go, IE7. Just to... quick jump back to what I was talking about, user agent sniffing. So if I go navigator, you see that now it does say that it's IE7. So if you remember that I was saying that browsers lie, this is technically IE9, because if I go document.createElement, can play type. That failed last time. Whoops.
Recently,
not yet. Oh, yeah. No, I was testing that before that if you set the document mode to IE9, you can think that it's IE7 through user agent sniffing, but you can still use the video tag. So don't use user agent sniffing. If you take anything away from this talk, it's don't use user agent sniffing. I'm going to change that back to IE9, otherwise I'm going to forget and then be in a world of pain at work one day. So that's Knockout.js in a quick nutshell. Some other really cool things that I haven't shown you with this Knockout.js demo, I mean, I could do a whole 75 minutes just on Knockout itself, is that we've got template binding. So like I was doing in the Amplify.js example where I was binding up that Twitter feed, we can use templating within that. I quickly showed it in the talk I was in yesterday. So we can bind templates to our view model so that collections will be displayed in, say, a bit more complex set of HTML. Some other useful things is that there's an extension for Knockout.js, so when we get data back from as just a JavaScript object, so you've done an AJAX request and you get some data back, you can convert that into a Knockout.js view model. You'll see that I was using new Knockout.observables around the place. And if we don't use observables, then Knockout is unable to do the watching of, say, text fields and buttons, etc. There's a plugin for Knockout that will take just a raw JavaScript object and turn it into something that Knockout understands that you can then bind to your UI. So come see me afterwards if you want any more information on that kind of stuff. So just as a recap, Knockout is an MVVM library for JavaScript. There's a couple other libraries for doing similar kinds of things, implementing different patterns, MVC patterns or the like. But personally, I find Knockout.js is my favorite of all the libraries, just because it, particularly because it's got a very familiar syntax with the data binding. It's something that, being a .NET developer, I'm used to code in that manner. I really like the fact that it's got the automatic event wire up, so it will take what I'm the buttons that I've got and automatically wire up those clicks to do what I require them to do, or wire up the text change events, things like that. And yeah, as I keep saying, it's very familiar if you're coming from a WPF or Silverlight background. So we all like websites that are pretty. There's nothing more boring than a website that is just black and white text and it's all kind of monospace and there's nothing cool about it. I mean, demos have to pop. So I want to talk about an SVG library now. So SVGs are scalable vector graphics, and they're a way of using XML and kind of weird maths or something. I don't know. I'm not a maths person anywhere near like Adam was in the keynote. I sat there and was completely blown away by what he was talking about and went, I don't even understand half of this. What's a prime number? Okay, no, not that bad. But so SVGs are a really cool way to do rich graphics within a website. So I want to talk about a library called Raphael. It's actually written by a guy in Australia, so it's nothing like homegrown software. Oh, one last thing. All these libraries that I've talked about today are open source, so you can get them for free, and that's awesome as well. So I'll just jump over to my demo here. Five. We'll spin this up in the browser, and it's going to do nothing very exciting. It's going to error again. There we go. Okay, so what I've done here is I've displayed a block of text. Round of applause. Just kidding. Yeah, seriously, if you're going to applause for a block of text, you're going to get blown away by the rest of these demos. So what I've done here is I've used the Raphael API to display some text on a drawing interface. So down here I've got a div called playground, and that's what I'm drawing into. But why is this kind of interesting? So what I'm doing here is writing out something that is just standard text at the moment. It's got a standard font and all that kind of stuff. But with Raphael, I can use a more complex font. So if I didn't have a browser that, say, supported the at font face option, I could use Raphael to then do that using SVGs. Raphael supports everything from IE6 upwards. It will fall back to VML, which was the initial IE implementation of an XML graphics in the browser. So we'll fall back to that up until IE9 that does have SVG support. Something also that is really useful about this is the text is actually text. These are DOM elements that I can interact with. I can style them with CSS. If my search engines support JavaScript scraping, this text can be scraped because it's actually text in the browser. Unlike if I was using an image for my, say, company logo, that won't necessarily be scraped unless it's a really smart search engine. This is text and can be indexed a whole lot easier. But Raphael can do things that are a lot more interesting than write text to a screen. Here we're going to draw some shapes. So just to show the power of this as a image library, I want to draw a couple of shapes on the screen. So I'm going to draw a circle, a rectangle, and then a path. So if you've ever worked with SVGs, you'll know what a path is. A path is that blue line that I've got up here. So this is, here's our circle that I've drawn. Here's a box. I've done an overlay just to show that these SVGs can deal with opacity as well, so you can layer graphics and get your rich effects from that. And then I've got this path here. So this is just a random shape that I decided to draw. And you'll see that, oops, wrong one. As I zoom in, the graphics are still staying at a really rich, clear form. So it still is an actual curve. It's not starting to get jagged edges if I was just using a graphic, a standard PNG or anything like that. Oops, controls the Win 0. Whoa. Wrong key. But what if we wanted to do... those graphics are not all that interesting. What if I wanted to do something that's a bit more complex? Little golf man. So this is just trying to illustrate the power that you can get from an SVG. This is quite a complex graphic that I've drawn out. And this is just done using a series of paths. So it does whatever an SVG is actually doing under the scenes and maps out this graphic. So as I zoom in, it is still the same clear graphic that you get when you first load it up. So this is why SVGs are really good for say something like a logos and things like that, because they don't lose focus as if people are visually impaired and they increase the screen resolution in their browsers, they zoom in, you still get the same rich graphics that you initially wanted. The last thing I wanted to show with Raphael, just to really illustrate the power that you can get from this particular library. So this is shamelessly stolen from the Raphael website. I just want to illustrate a couple of things here. So Raphael supports animations. So the kinds of things that you would, say, be doing with a Silverlight animation, we can do them with SVGs. I could do something like take these two paths and animate them into a single path. We'll take this really complex path and turn it into an infinity sign and change the scaling of something like that. And it still is a good-looking graphic. It's not actually becoming jagged edges or anything like that. I can do text animation that's not quite as smooth in IE, just for the way IE handles SVG text. It's not quite as smooth as it could be in the other browsers. We do other things that animate, change shape. So what I'm saying here is that it's very similar to things that we could have done for years with Silverlight. We can do them still in this new scary HTML5 world. So just to recap, Raphael is an awesome SVG library. So obviously the examples I've given here today are kind of sandboxed and flashy for demos, but SVGs can really start becoming powerful if you wanted to, say, build charts. Say you wanted to represent a bar chart and you want to have them animate in, or you wanted a pie chart. When you click on a section of the pie, it extends out, or you can interact with it like that. You can get some really rich graphics using SVGs and using a library such as Raphael. Raphael does have a charting extension to it called Graphael as well, so definitely worth looking into if you're interested in doing charting. Some other cool things you can do is such as load in images. So you can actually load an image in as an SVG. Yeah. That kind of wraps it up for me today. Here's a list of all the tools that I've talked about throughout this talk. So HTML5 boilerplate, Modernizer, yep, nope, AmplifyJS, KnockoutJS, Raphael. Down the bottom is my contact information. So hit me up on Twitter, or if you feel like sending me an email for whatever reason. I'm going to go change my email address. And lastly, I don't have the eval slides. That's problematic. Don't forget to do your evals. I'll leave this slide up then, since I don't have the other ones. Don't forget to fill out your evals. We really do appreciate any feedback you can give us on this, these talks. So definitely do that. And there's prizes that you can win for filling out your evals, stuff like that. Any questions or lunch? It's not lunchtime. Any questions? Yep.